Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. August 30th, 2021, 3 p.m. in the afternoon. With me today is Co-Chair Bishop. Senator Von Imhoff's excused. We have Senator Olson, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Wilson are online. Myself, Stedman. We have one item today. We're going to have a conversation dealing with the interpretation of the sweepable funds and the sweep itself, which we've dealt with many times here at the table. So we have invited with us today Mr. Alexi Painter from Legislative Finance. We have Mr. Neil Steininger, Director of the OMB. We should have, yes, we have Corey Mills from Deputy Attorney General online. We also have the Megan Wallace, Director of Legislative Legal, and then we have Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor, and I'll probably have her come up at the end for a few questions. With that, I'd like to go ahead and start off with Alexi Painter, if he can come forward, please. And we might, Mr. Painter, we might want to, although we work with this a lot here at the table, we might want to, for those watching at home, we might want to give it a brief definitional, so those that aren't familiar with this can then follow the conversation of what we're talking about and why it's important.
For the record, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division. And so this is the slide packet I presented a week ago today, but I'll just cover a couple of these items before turning it over to the administration. So just as a quick refresher on the CBR sweep mechanism, the CBR sweep is established in the Constitution, Article 9, Section 17. Item D in that section establishes a repayment requirement that states that if an appropriation is made from the Budget Reserve Fund, until the amount appropriated is repaid, the amount of money in the general fund available for appropriation at the end of each succeeding fiscal year shall be deposited in the Budget Reserve Fund. The legislature shall implement this subsection by law. And so on the next couple of slides, I'll skip a little bit, but essentially the reverse sweep here on slide 3 is an appropriation from the CBR that returns swept funds back to the original subfunder account. The reverse sweep is an appropriation under Article 9, Section 17C, meaning that it requires a three-quarter vote to pass. The sweep is effective at the end of a fiscal year, June 30th, and then the reverse sweep is effective on the first day of the following fiscal year, so July 1st. Essentially, the money is transferred from those accounts to the CBR at 11:59 p.m. on June 30th, and then 1 minute later on July 1st, the money is returned back to those funds in a typical year. So in actuality, the money doesn't usually move, but on paper, it does get swept in and reversed.
Okay. And just for a point of clarification, what he's talking about is having these accounts start with a balance greater than zero, because if the sweep isn't reversed, the balance on most of these funds would be zero, except for there's a few anomalies within that list. But basically, we're constituting a beginning account balance for cash flow purposes. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, if you'll allow, I'll skip over the next couple of slides just because they're talking about the sweep, and then go to slide 5, which is how the sweep works, so the actual mechanics of how it's taken, how it is carried out. The Department of Administration's Division of Finance, or DOF as it's often called, their accountants calculate the sweep while preparing the annual comprehensive financial report, or ACFR. The sweep represents the unreserved, undesignated fund balances of the general fund subfunds. And they calculate that in September as the ACFR is prepared, but the amount of the sweep is posted in the financial records as of the end of the fiscal year, so back to June 30th. And then after the ACFR is prepared, historically by the end of October, a little bit later the last few years, the ACFR is then audited by the legislative auditor. The sweep amount is adjusted as necessary. So just to reiterate, the kind of classic view of the sweep is that the amounts reported in the ACFR are just representing the balances as of June 30th, with only adjustments for appropriations that have taken effect by June 30th. And that's what's posted in the act for each year. So we could move on to the impacts of the sweep on the budget. That's slide 8. So prior to the new interpretation of the mechanics of the sweep, the Legislative Finance Division analyzed the FY22 budget to see what the impacts of the sweep would be on that budget if not reversed. The FY22 budget uses $321.2 million from sweepable funds after the PCE's removal. However, not all funds are impacted equally. We had, in our analysis, designated some that they would have an immediate impact because there was no ongoing source of revenue to support appropriations. There were others with a partial impact, meaning there was an ongoing source of revenue, but it was insufficient to support the appropriations in FY22. And then minimal or no impact, meaning that the ongoing source of revenue fully covered appropriations, or in many cases, there were no appropriations from that fund source in the FY22 budget. And going on to slide 9, so by category, and then just adding one more category is the immediate impact pending interpretation, and that's the statutory budget reserve. That one at this point is still a sweepable fund. However, there's suggestions that it may not be sweepable based on the findings in the AFN court ruling a few weeks ago. So the key numbers here at the bottom, that the projected sweep balance is nearly $1 billion. $321.2 million, as I said, was used out of these funds. And then there's some ongoing revenue to those funds in the bottom two categories, $181.8 million, leaving a shortfall for these various accounts of $141.95 million, or about $142 million. So that was our projected shortfall of where the ongoing revenue was insufficient to make the appropriations. And the administration will speak about how that may be impacted by their new reinterpretation of the sweep mechanics. And then, Mr. Chairman, would you like me to go through the impacts in more detail, or turn it over at this point?
Well, you can, you could, because it might be new for some people.
Sure.
So you can give us a brief review of that.
So slide 10, the immediate impacts. The top one is the Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund. That has no ongoing source of revenue other than investment earnings on that fund balance. And so the entire amount of appropriations made out of that fund would be a shortfall due to the lack of a reverse sweep. So no appropriations would have been valid. And then similarly with the statutory budget reserve, which is in kind of limbo right now, but if that is swept, then all of the appropriations out of that fund would be hollow as well. And the next slide shows some of the items that were funded with the statutory budget reserve. So that included $330 million of appropriations that were vetoed, as well as $80.5 million of appropriations that were part of the FY22 budget and not vetoed. Primarily, those were for capital projects, but a small amount also for the school debt reimbursement program. The next slide shows the partial impacts. So these are the funds where there's some ongoing revenue, but it's insufficient to fully offset the appropriations. The projected sweep balance of these funds is $104.5 million, but we use $168.5 million in the FY22 budget because, again, we're assuming there's going to be ongoing revenue in many of these funds. And so a lot of these are designated taxes where there is ongoing revenue, but there may be a balance, so we utilize more than the ongoing revenue in the budget. The amount available after the CBR sweep is essentially that ongoing revenue, and these numbers are based on DOR's spring forecast. Then the shortfall is the difference between that ongoing revenue and the appropriations. So this shows essentially how much of the prior fund balance was being used in the budget in FY22 that without the reverse sweep, again, would have been a hole totaling about $39.5 million. Then going on to the minimal or no impact, these are funds that many of which were not used in the FY22 budget, such as the Vessel Replacement Fund or the Rail Belt Energy Fund. Others, they were used in the budget, but the amount used was less or equal to the amount of ongoing revenue. An example would be the TVEP account 1151, which after a fiscal note is in balance, so there's no gap there. And so these funds, while there is some swept balance, the ongoing revenue is sufficient to pay for all of the appropriations out of these funds. And so with that, if there's no more questions for me, I'll turn it over to the OMB director.
All right, let's see. We'll go. Any questions, Senator? We'll go online. Do we have questions from any of the three senators online?
None from me.
Okay, hearing none, we'll go ahead and let Mr. Painter off the hot seat. We'll bring up the OMB director and Mr. Steininger, if you could come forward. And I think we have Corey Mills online. I think there'll be a lifeline thrown to her almost immediately, and that's okay. But Mr. Steininger, could you help me with the new interpretation of decades of dealing with the reverse sweep and in these accounts, why there was a sudden change from your presentation on August 24th that we all have here on our desk going through the reverse sweep, and then on August 25th or shortly thereafter, 27th, whenever it was executed, a radical change in direction. Can you kind of walk us through that if you could?
Yes, thank you. For the record, Neil Steininger, Director, Office of Management and Budget. So on August 25th, the Attorney General Taylor, sent a memo to the governor outlining that appropriations made in HB 69 could be counted as valid commitments since the bill was signed into law prior to midnight on June 30th. The Office of Management and Budget then subsequently was forwarded that memo, as well as a memo instructing us to implement that interpretation and release any funds from sweepable funds appropriated in HB 69. So what that means in sort of layman's terms is those impacts that Director Painter just walked through no longer will, you know, those shortfalls due to the sweep will no longer impact those appropriations. So what we've done is we've now released those funds, but only those funds that were validly appropriated in HB 69. The balances of the funds themselves will still sweep per the terms of the Constitution. The only change is what counts as a valid commitment under that constitutional provision. And so that's what OMB has been instructed to execute on, and what the Attorney General opinion defines. As you noted on August 24th, when I presented, we were still operating under the prior interpretation of, you know, the commitments not being validly committed until their effective date. However, this AG's opinion has changed that interpretation. So it's when there's a commitment, not necessarily when there's a valid appropriation.
So do you recall offhand just roughly how long we've operated under the previous guidelines? Has it been like a couple years, or has it been decades?
Chair Stemman, to my knowledge, since we began interpreting the sweep in the annual comprehensive financial reports. So since the early 90s.
Early what?
90s.
Early 1990s, last
yes.
Century.
Yes.
Okay. And then on the SBR, the statutory budget reserve, with the court ruling dealing with AFN and the power cost equalization, it's inferred in there that the statutory budget reserve is not sweepable. Why would you not want to follow that?
Chair Stemman, the AFN case, you know, directly ordered us to not sweep the power cost equalization fund. There was reference to the statutory budget reserve in a footnote of that case, but there wasn't a direct order not to sweep the statutory budget reserve. Until we receive guidance otherwise, we're continuing to apply kind of the status quo interpretation of the statutory budget reserve being sweepable.
Was there an order in there to reinterpret the rest of the sweep items other than the PCE?
Chair Stemmen, in the AFN decision, yes. No, I do not believe there was, but Corey Mills can correct me if necessary.
Senator Bishop.
Could you be more specific for me? The rest of them probably got it, but you said guidance. Guidance from who?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop. Until we receive direction from either the Attorney General or the courts in terms of changing the interpretation of the statutory budget reserve, the status of the statutory budget reserve when it comes to sweepability, we'll continue to follow the status quo as we have in prior years of considering that fund to be sweepable.
Thank you.
Okay. So we had kind of a conflict between the status quo and something's not status quo. You have a question? Was it Senator Wilikowski?
No, Senator Wilson.
Senator Wilson, you have a question?
Yes. Mr. Steininger, would the PCE court decision also include all other payments made out of that account to, let's say, like community assistance?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes. So any appropriation from the Power Cost Equalization Fund per the AFN decision was allowed to go forward and is now being implemented in the state budget. So that includes community assistance, power cost equalization program itself, the cost of managing the fund, and other appropriations from that fund.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions for
Yes, Mr. Stein? I do, Mr. Chairman. This is Bill Wilikowski.
Yeah, Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, I'm just curious about how this impacts the SBR appropriations.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, per this memo and the direction from the governor, those appropriations were considered to be validly committed prior to the time of the sweep, so those appropriations can go forward.
So that's like the West Ossetna Access Road and the Houston School and a couple others?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that's correct. Primarily capital projects.
Thank you.
Concentrated in a geographical area, those projects are. Help the committee with the mechanics of the sweep, and are you gonna, how is the cash flow gonna work? Are you gonna, do you have to wait to receive revenue and then you're gonna spend it, or are you gonna spend other revenue, or walk me through the mechanics of this interpretation.
Chair Stemmen, the mechanics will operate similar to in a year where the reverse sweep did occur. So the appropriations, the departments will be able to execute on those appropriations. We utilize something called interfund borrowing in situations where revenue may be, you know, less in the first quarter than is necessary for expenditures, but will be adequate over the course of the entire fiscal year. So in some situations, there will be that, you know, lag between expenditures and revenue. That's fairly normal in operations of the state budget. These funds, the situations in which we're relying upon a balance in the fund, will be able to expend from that balance. There will be, you know, accounting reconciliation done by the Division of Finance to ensure that, you know, the amount swept into the CBR is accurate. That's something that we have to work through with the Division of Finance on to ensure that the adequate tracking and adequate accounting for that happens in the annual comprehensive financial report.
So dealing with that, should the CAFR, should the committee then expect that the CAFR is gonna have less complications and flagged issues in it or more?
Chair Stemmen, I don't necessarily want to speculate on that. I know that Division of Finance works as hard as possible to ensure that there's not issues in the ACFR when it's submitted over to Division of Legislative Audit. But, you know, I can't speculate as to, you know, what this will do to, you know, the production of the financial report.
Okay, well, we'll have that question asked a little later to another party. Do we have any other initial questions for Mr. Steininger before we ask Ms. Mills, the Deputy Attorney General, a couple questions?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Wilkowski again?
Yes, go ahead, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, so as I'm reading it, it looks like the Matsu Borough pavement rehabilitation of $10 million is approved, and I'm just curious if that basically goes to pave some of the roads up there. And I'm just curious if the Matsu Borough has road conditions that are worse than other parts of the state that necessitate this discretionary $10 million, or whether the governor plans to veto that.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, the governor's opportunity whether or not to veto that appropriation happened when the bill was signed. And we put forward that request for an appropriation, which was appropriated by the legislature on account of road conditions in that region.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, go ahead.
So what you're saying is the roads in Matsu that, well, by the way, the discretion to use these funds is for the Matsu Borough, but it's the governor's position that the roads in Matsu are worse than the roads in rural Alaska and in certain parts of Anchorage, Alaska, and other parts of Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not meaning to imply that there's a worse or better conditions of the roads, simply that this appropriation was something put forward during session, was vetted during session and appropriated by the legislature, and it is impacted by this memo from Attorney General Taylor as to whether or not the funds from the appropriation can be put forward to be executed, you know, based on the interpretation of what funds are subject to the sweep or not. That interpretation doesn't have any bearing over the, you know, validity of a project or the need. It's simply a look at the legal issues surrounding determining what balances are available for sweep.
We'll have brief at ease. Is this in the... On the record, just for clarity, the budget director is correct that the legislature is the appropriating body, and we did appropriate these funds. They came in as an amendment from the governor for the capital budget, and the legislature did not add any projects to the capital budget. They were all either recommended in the bond package or amendments from the administration. Just for clarity. And all appropriations that were in the final bill were approved with the vote of the legislature. So that part of it is correct. Just wanted to fill in a couple gaps. And Senator Wilkowski, do you have a follow-up question on that issue or other issues?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I'm curious if the director can explain why the Attorney General is interpreting the end of the succeeding fiscal year to come after the start of the next fiscal year?
Could you restate that? I wasn't.
Yeah, it's a little complicated, but it's in the Attorney General's opinion, and maybe it's a question better for the Department of Law. But I'm just curious why if the testifier knows why the Attorney General is interpreting the end of the succeeding fiscal year to come after the start of the next fiscal year.
Right. We're going to get into that, I think, Senator Wilkowski, with a question for the Attorney General's assistant or Deputy Attorney General herself here in a minute. I think it'd be better targeted. Other questions for the OMB director? He
would rather... Yeah, I did have another question, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, go ahead, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. I'm just curious if the governor believes that the oil tax credits should be funded at the full or more statutory level if the permanent fund dividend is funded at less than the statutory level, if he believes that's fair.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, in our budget during session, we put forward the full amount for oil and gas tax credits, and we also put forward proposals to pay a dividend at a 50-50 dividend split based on the proposals that we have put forward for a fiscal plan for the state.
Okay. Any other,
Chairman?
Yeah, another follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
Would the governor support an amendment that linked the amount of the permanent fund dividend to the amount of oil tax credits, the percentage?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't think I can answer that question on behalf of the governor.
Okay. Any other questions for OMB director? Hearing none, Mr. Steininger, you can, well, just why don't you just stay there in the hot seat because Ms. Mills isn't here. And I know you want to jump out of it, but that's okay. Ms. Corey Mills from the Deputy Attorney General's Office, if you could give us an opening, please, on the subject at hand, particularly the memorandum dated the 25th of August, reinterpretation of the sweep, and we'll have a series of questions, I'm sure, when you're done.
Thank you, Senator Steadman. This is Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General from the Department of Law. I hope I'm coming through okay.
Yes.
Okay, great. So yes, I will, I'm happy to start with just a brief explanation of the memorandum that Director Steininger referred to. So as Director Steininger said, you know, we were asked by the governor to look at this question of basically the question of monies for which an appropriation for expenditure had already been enacted prior to the sweep, were those not available for appropriation because they had already been validly committed. So I just want to start out by saying one of the things I think that the Power Cost Equalization Endowment Fund case highlighted is that there's still a lot of uncertainty around the interpretation of the constitutional budget reserve. We have one Supreme Court case, Hickel versus Cooper, two interpreting the clause, but one interpreting the phrase available for appropriation. And there are still a series of unanswered questions about the interpretation of that, especially as it relates to the sweep and subsection D, because the Hickel versus Cooper case dealt mostly with subsection B, which is, you know, how you do the comparison between the previous year and what money is available for appropriation to determine if you can take out money by a majority vote or by a three-quarters vote from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. So framing that, you know, we were asked this question by the governor, and we found that there's a reasonable argument based on a reading of Hickel versus Cooper and the interpretation of available for appropriation that funds that were already, where an appropriation was already enacted, even if it wasn't effective, it was already enacted, and therefore those funds, those monies, amounts, had already been validly committed to be expended for a specific purpose in the future, and that because it was validly committed, that meant that it was not available for appropriation as of June 30th at midnight and should not be swept with the remainder of the funds. There's two kind of quotes from Hickel versus Cooper I'll just go over because this is really the crux of this question and evaluating the question. So first of all, Hickel, the case defined available for appropriation in the following manner. Amount available for appropriation within the meaning of Article 9, Section 17 of the Alaska Constitution includes all monies over which the legislature has retained the power to appropriate and which require further appropriation before expenditure. The court in Hickel also made clear, and this is another quote from the case, monies which have already been validly committed by the legislature to some purpose should not be counted as available. So if you're looking at, you know, HB 69, which was enacted, I believe, signed on June 30th, and those appropriations in the bill that were signed into law, the question is, are those validly committed prior to the sweep and therefore should not be swept and should be instead, you know, used for those purposes in the future on their effective dates? Or are they not validly committed yet because they were not effective yet? And we believe there is a reasonable argument looking at Hickel versus Cooper that they were validly committed and therefore, you know, the action and direction given by the governor based on that analysis we think is legally defensible and could be upheld by the court. But ultimately, we don't know what the court will determine on this.
So how, Ms. Mills, how did 30 years, roughly, not quite 30 years, but, you know, a dick, almost, well, in the early 90s, I guess, 94, Hickel versus Cooper, almost 30 years of precedence has no waiting? How did you deal with that issue? Or was all the other previous governors and legislators, OMB directors, finance directors, misinterpreting this particular maneuver?
Chair Stedman, I think this question has always been out there. It just wasn't highlighted, and we hadn't had a governor really ask for it, to be honest. And there's, you know, always a chance that when you analyze things that there's questions that could go both ways. And the policy calls on all sides had been to go forward in one way for 30 years. That definitely weighs into things, but that doesn't mean there's not a reasonable argument that maybe it hadn't been done correctly for all those years. We've seen the Supreme Court definitely reverse things like the permanent fund dividend and the Willikowski decision where they reversed, you know, 30 to 40 years of action. So, you know, we're always looking at the case law, looking at what the Constitution says, looking at the recent PCE decision where there's questions there that could upend 30 years of the way it has been interpreted. So I don't really have a further answer. We just think there's a reasonable argument. There's a reasonable argument on the other side, too.
So on the closing paragraph in the memorandum August 25th to the governor from Attorney General, the lead-in, third, fourth, and fifth word is and particularly concern, particular concern. It looks to me like the Attorney General's concern is the administration is going to be on thin ice on a hot day on this interpretation. So I'm just kind of curious on your impression of some of this verbiage. And in the lead into your second paragraph in the letter, there is a reasonable argument these, you know, monies, you know, can be expended, a reasonable argument. You can make a reasonable argument on virtually anything in a courtroom. So help me understand the thickness of the ice.
Chair Stedman, I hope I'm addressing your question, but if not, please reframe it. I think this, when you say there's a reasonable legal argument, of course you can make reasonable legal arguments in court. I guess the question, you know, you're always looking, is it a more than 50% chance? Is it you know, are we at 90%? Are we beyond a reasonable doubt? I think this is one that could go either way, and the courts have not had an opportunity to weigh in on it. So I think this is a strong, reasonable argument, but I also understand why there were 30 years where it wasn't interpreted this way. So, you know, this is a case where we're not going to know until the Alaska Supreme Court weighs in. We could have either been sued on our current interpretation, like we were with the PCE, or we could, we were back in the day with available for appropriation based on the statute that was passed, you know, or we could have this and be sued on this interpretation. So I think these are good legal arguments to make before a court, but ultimately we're not the ultimate decision maker.
In our Constitution, we have an appointed attorney general. We don't have an elected attorney general. And what concerns me is the 30 years of precedence being turned on its head when there's a substantial capital budget waiting within one region of the state. And it just seems to be a little interesting that these two issues happen to coincide. And we don't have an elected attorney general, but some of us are getting concerned that maybe we should start thinking about changing that, because of the interpretations coming out of the Department of Law seem to be politically motivated. Do we have questions for Ms. Mills? Senator Wilkowski, you had a date question concerning the end of the fiscal year and the beginning of another.
Yeah, I had a couple questions, Mr. Chair. I guess the first one is, as I read the AFN case, the big rationale for the court was that funds that were outside the general fund were not considered to be sweepable. I'm just curious the rationale on the higher education fund. Then the governor reversed his position on that, and I'm glad he did. But I want to maybe flesh out the analysis there a little bit, because that's within the general fund, correct?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, you're absolutely correct. I do not believe, and I leave this for the director to say from a policy position, I do not believe they changed their position on the higher education fund and its sweepability as a fund. The reason the performance scholarships can go out is because there were validly committed appropriations in HB 69 to pay the performance scholarships this year. The remainder of the fund is considered swept as of June 30th, so there will be no money in there to pay scholarships next year.
We have a follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Yes, thank you for that explanation and clarification. Just on the date issue, it appears the Attorney General is interpreting the end of the succeeding fiscal year to come after the start of the next fiscal year. Am I correct in that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, so the question is, the monies been validly committed? Like I said, Hickel versus Cooper used language that said monies which have already been validly committed by the legislature to some purpose should not be counted as available. So if the money had already been validly committed, that is a separate question from when the appropriation is effective, when the money can be spent. And so the language in subsection D says the amount of money in the general fund available for appropriation, at the end of each succeeding fiscal year. Well, is that money that was already committed to a purpose, is that available for appropriation at the end of the fiscal year, or has it been validly committed for the future, for the next year's budget, and so is kind of set aside, you know, just like you get a hold on your credit card for certain things, but it doesn't go through for, you know, until a certain action has taken place. So that would be, I don't think it's a matter of the money has to already be spent. That's really the question. Does it have to be effective? Does it have to be able to be spent as of June 30th? Or does it have to be validly committed through an enacted bill for the future? So that's the legal question we were weighing. And I just want to comment quickly on, you know, in terms of our role is to advise the governor and other officials within the government. And that's exactly what we did in this memo. We're not saying it's a clear answer, and we're not saying the attorney general's, we haven't taken a public position on this. We're saying there's reasonable arguments on both sides. And ultimately, if there's reasonable legal arguments, that's a policy question for elected officials to make.
Well, Ms. Mills, sure. It sounds like you want to take half a step back from this particular position as a department. So I read your last comments. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, and it's an interesting interpretation that, I mean, the legislature's budget control was over FY22 after the end of the last fiscal year when the funds were already swept. But another question I had was a question I asked our legislative attorneys. I'm curious what your thoughts are. In going forward, could the legislature make an appropriation or simply transfer funds from these various different funds that are out there into the statutory budget reserve, let's say, or the power cost equalization fund, and then transfer them back as of the new fiscal year as a maneuver to avoid the funds getting swept?
Senator Wilikowski, that's a really interesting question. I'm going to focus on the power cost equalization endowment fund, since we know that one is not sweepable as a whole, and that it sits in AEA, so under the court's reasoning, it is not sweepable. So if the legislature were to appropriate, you know, money into the power cost equalization fund, that would definitely be protected from the sweep. And then I guess your second question is, then you have an appropriation to take it out of the power cost equalization and put it somewhere else, the higher ed fund, for example, or just the general fund. And that would occur after the sweep. Am I getting those facts correct?
Yes.
Okay. So through the chair, I'm just trying to think through this on the fly. I think in the end that would potentially be protected. You know, also keeping, you can always appropriate money from the power cost equalization endowment fund anyway, so I don't know that the second step is that necessary, because you could just, you know, use the power cost equalization endowment fund essentially as a mini general fund anyway. So I don't see a difference in either of those approaches. I think either way, if the funds are in the power cost equalization fund, they would not be swept.
Thank you.
We have other questions? I just wondered, can you help me with Ms. Mills on dealing with the retroactive effective dates with this new, well, I guess back up a little bit. You know, the administration or the was threatening to shut down the government for 90 days because of the lack of a two-thirds vote for retroactive effective dates. So with this new interpretations, is it retroactive effective dates? Should we just delete those out of our budgets, or can you help us with that and how this is all intertwined?
Chair Stedman, I think those are actually distinct legal questions. I definitely understand why they would seem to be intertwined, but here we're interpreting the phrase available for appropriation for purposes of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And the Hickel versus Cooper court used the term, you know, basically, have the funds been validly committed by the legislature to some purpose? Does that have a time component? Is it now? Is it before the sweep? Or can it be validly committed for the future? So when something would be effective or retroactive, you know, and on the effective date then go back in time and be retroactive, I think is a separate question that's not really impacted by this particular analysis, okay. I think.
So going forward then, is it going to be possible to get a clarification on this for the next budget cycle, in that here, similar to this situation where you have decades of precedence on how the interpretations from multiple legislatures, governors, and attorney generals and OMB directors, and then we have a 90-degree change because there seems to be some political expediency for that. There's just too many of these there's too many of these just to be coincidence. So can you help the Finance Committee with any type of information on this issue with retroactive effective dates?
Chair Stedman, I think we're happy to provide you know, the guidance we can. I will say that the effective date litigation, you know, the timeline for us appealing that is coming up. So there is a chance that there will be, you know, continued litigation at the Supreme Court level on that. I think our hope, if we decide to pursue that, I don't know what the decision is going to be, but is to get clarity from the court so that we don't have a constitutional crisis come upon us. And I don't think that, I don't think we'd ever faced that exact situation on an entire general appropriation bill. We looked back in history and couldn't really find a similar circumstance. You know, there's some supplemental issues, but it was definitely a new issue, at least when we looked back in Department of Law, that we hadn't opined on something that large without any basis in any prior appropriation, putting those into effect. But we're happy to look at that, and hopefully if we do pursue this, maybe we'll get clarity for the court before the budget process is over. But we're also happy to weigh in on, you know, how we think the retroactive dates and the effective dates work together in any particular bill.
And we'll probably have that opportunity, I'm sure, this winter, so we don't have these concocted, in my opinion, constitutional crisis on an ongoing basis. And it's getting expensive to the Treasury to deal with this stuff. So there's some concern with that also. We have any other comments from or questions for Ms. Mills? Appreciate it for you coming forward today and helping us with this. We just need to get some of this stuff sorted out. I'd like to have Megan Wallace come forward, please. We'll let Mr. Steininger out of the hot seat. Megan Wallace, she's Director of Legislative Legal Services. She's here to help us understand the subjects in front of us today, I guess.
Good afternoon. For the record, Megan Wallace, Legal Services Director. I have just a few comments from Legal Services perspective in terms of the opinion that was issued last week by the Attorney General, and just how it, whether or not it changes our historical understanding of how the sweep works and how it could be carried out, and potentially if what risk there is to the legislature moving forward if it operates or continues to budget under the most recent interpretation. So as it relates to the Attorney General opinion, more generally, I think as Ms. Mills articulated to the committee, I agree, you know, this issue has never been before the Alaska Supreme Court. So we all agree that there is no Supreme Court decision that governs this issue or dictates or gives us guidance on how we should analyze this issue. And there are, Ms. Mills noted that there is no new case law on this issue. Yes, we had a recent Superior Court decision on the sweepability of the PCE fund, but the Department of Law's new opinion on how the sweep should be carried out does not rely on that most recent opinion. So the opinion and our framework is based on almost exclusively on the Hickel v. Cooper, which we've all been discussing here this afternoon, which is an Alaska Supreme Court from the early 90s. And based on the Hickel v. Cooper case from, I believe it was 1994, just kind of taking a step back to understand what Hickel v. Cooper was and what Hickel v. Cooper was not. The Hickel v. Cooper case was, as Ms. Mills mentioned, was a case about the definition of what it means to be available for appropriation under the context of Article 9, Section 17B, which is the provision that tells you whether or not you need a majority vote or the three-quarter vote. Hickel v. Cooper, in large part, did not touch on the constitutional sweep in Section 17D. There is one small section at the end of the opinion that references the sweep and says that for the purposes of understanding what it means, what the language in the sweep provision is we will look to the same interpretation as those terms are used in subsection B. And that is the limited guidance that we got from Hickel v. Cooper as it relates to the sweep. So in terms of the quotations or the statements that the Hickel v. Cooper court made that the Department of Law is relying on, those statements by the court were in interpreting Section 17B of the Constitutional Budget Reserve provision and not specific to the sweep. When we're analyzing and we're determining whether or not money was validly committed by the legislature, the Hickel v. Cooper case is not specific as to what that means as it relates to the sweep, right? Does that mean that we are looking to see what money has been validly committed as of June 30th when we're carrying out the sweep? Or do we look to the future to see what future appropriations are going to take effect and whether or not we can consider those validly committed? Our office has historically understood and interpreted the sweep as a snapshot of what you look at on June 30th and has historically considered that money that is swept on June 30th would not be available to carry out appropriations that had been validly enacted for the upcoming fiscal year. In other words, after the sweep occurred, if there was not a reverse, that those appropriations would go unfunded. Without a change in law or updated guidance from the Alaska Supreme Court or even a Superior Court specifically taking up this issue, it's difficult to reach a new conclusion from my perspective.
So can you help us with the statutory budget reserve? There seems to be some interpretation differences there also. And can you clarify that for the committee and the people at home, please?
Sure. So before the recent litigation on the PCE fund, there had been pretty general consensus that the statutory budget reserve fund was a sweepable fund, and that was based on also based on language in Hickel v. Cooper. In Hickel v. Cooper, the state agreed that, or basically the parties had conceded that the money in the statutory budget reserve fund was available for appropriation. And so there had never been a suggestion after that that fund should not be considered sweepable. Fast forward to the recent PCE litigation, and we now have a case from the Anchorage Superior Court that, in analyzing whether or not the PCE fund was in the general fund, which is also a requirement for a fund to be sweepable, it noted that the legislature has the constitutional power to create funds outside of the general fund. And in that decision, the court noted that the legislature has created separate funds and then footnotes and specifically lists certain funds which the legislature has created separate from the general fund. And one of those funds is the statutory budget reserve fund. And so before the AFN case, we had never had a court analyze whether or not the statutory budget reserve fund is in the general fund and whether it's subject to the sweep. So based on the AFN case that was not appealed by the governor, if there were a subsequent challenge to the sweepability of the statutory budget reserve fund, if a court were to find the Anchorage Superior Court opinion persuasive, a court would likely find that the statutory budget reserve fund is outside of the general fund and not subject to the sweep. The case is a Superior Court case. It's unpublished and therefore won't serve as precedent. If there were subsequent challenges, it can only at most be considered persuasive by another court that analyzes this issue. And so we do have still an open question to the extent that the Alaska Supreme Court hasn't heard this issue, but based on the AFN case, the statutory budget reserve fund would be considered outside the general fund and not subject to the sweep.
So do you have a recommendation for the Finance Committee how we should proceed from your perspective dealing with the SBR?
Mr. Chairman, the only recommendation that I can give is that I guess caution is warranted because we have a Superior Court case that pretty clearly seems to suggest that the statutory budget reserve fund is not sweepable, but the administration has not changed its position or recategorized the statutory budget reserve fund. So we could face another challenge in terms of differing opinions about what money is available and what money is not, and it could ultimately be something that needs to be decided, or the legislature, the other recommendation is to conservatively budget so that a new decision or interpretation on that issue does not disrupt budgeting assumptions that the legislature is making.
We have questions for Ms. Wallace.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, was that Senator, was it Olson and Wilson both, or who?
This is Senator Olson.
Okay, Senator Olson, go ahead. You can go first, and then I think it's Willikowski next.
No.
I'm Ms. Wallace, as you look at the getting off the statutory budget reserve, as you go back to the power cost equalization fund, if realizing that we have a Superior Court decision on that, what are your thoughts on if it was appealed to the Supreme Court, would that ruling stand, or do you think that'll be reversed from the way you're looking? From your perspective, and should we be taking that into consideration?
Through the chair, it's my understanding that the specific AFN case will not be appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court. So the only way that this issue could get back to the Supreme Court is if there was separate litigation that was undertaken, and then it thereby goes up to the Supreme Court, because our Supreme Court does not issue advisory opinions. They do not issue opinions just advising the branches of government what their position on certain legal issues are. There has to be an actual case or controversy and an actual appeal that's made to the Alaska Supreme Court. It's my opinion, you know, it's always difficult to predict what a court's going to do, but certainly the opinion in the AFN case seems well-reasoned and seems likely that the Supreme Court would uphold that decision, but I certainly can't sit here at the table and make any guarantees.
Thank you, Mr. Wall.
Senator Wilikowski.
No questions.
Senator Bishop.
Ms. Wallace, prior to this administration, every other administration considered the PCE. I mean, it never was considered sweepable. Is that right or wrong?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it's my understanding that the longstanding position on PCE, that it was not a sweepable fund, and that position changed upon issuance of an opinion by former Attorney General Kevin Clarkson, and then that's when the position on the PCE fund changed for the first time.
With the current administration. So it's relatively new. Senator Wilson, did you have any questions?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members offline or online, I should say? Okay, hearing none. Thank you, Ms. Wallace, for your time. And Ms. Curtis, the legislative auditor, could you come forward here, please, and jump in the hot seat? We'll have a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Ms. Curtis has been enthusiastically waiting to come to the table today, I'm sure, on this one. Ms. Curtis, if you can identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and I want to, and what you do, and we'll have a couple questions for you.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis. I'm your state legislative auditor, responsible for auditing the ACFRA.
Okay. So one of the concerns that the committee's had for a couple of years is the difficulty we've had in having cleaner or more timely audited financial statements put together for various reasons, some of which is a software upgrade, and some of which is internal accounting and agencies. And then we have this sweep issue in front of us. So I'd like to have your opinion as our auditor on this issue of when something is swept and there's an appropriation in that given fiscal year that day, first day of the year or whatever, how should we be looking at this from your lens in the auditing world?
Well, so the idea of what's available at the end of a fiscal year. You know, the accounting, the balance sheet is as of June 30th. So the idea of what is available at the end of June 30th, it has wider ramifications than just the sweep issue. We've got the idea of encumbrances, we've got fund balance. So one of my first concerns is a new interpretation of how to interpret the amount available has farther implications than just this issue. Another thought I have in listening to the testimony today is that, you know, this issue of what is available, it was vetted. When Hickler versus Cooper came out, it was vetted with the Department of Law, it was vetted with OMB, it was vetted with DOF, and it was vetted with legislative audit. As a group, we discussed this at length. So to have a reinterpretation and talk about that it wasn't necessarily investigated or properly thought out by the Department of Law, I don't necessarily agree with that interpretation. You know, I haven't read the PCE court case, so I don't know about what my thoughts are if I read that, whether I'll have that'll educate me or inform me in some other way of looking at this. From the audit perspective, obligation as of June 30th, I think would be very, very difficult to interpret an appropriation effective after June 30th as constituting a valid obligation as of June 30th. We will take a fresh look at this. My staff will take a thorough, deep dive into the justification from the Department of Law. We'll have discussions with Division of Finance. We'll examine it and come to a decision. You know, we already have a qualification on the state's financial statements. They do not have a clean opinion. And one of the issues has to do with...
Could you explain that to the public? What you're telling us?
Absolutely. So we give an opinion on the state's financial statements, whether they are fairly stated, whether they are free from material misstatement. There are five opinions, and one of them is on the general fund, and one of them is on governmental activities, which is relevant to this issue. We qualified the general fund partly because of the amounts that are being deposited into the CBR fund. The impact of that is $1.4 billion disagreement that we have with the administration, and it's leading to a qualified opinion, meaning that we believe there is a material misstatement in the general fund's financial statements.
Could you restate that? My hearing isn't as good as it used to be.
So we believe there is a material misstatement in the financial statements for the general fund, and it has to do with what we believe is defined on what is owed from the general fund to the CBR. And that has to do with the amounts that are deposited into the CBR versus the amounts that are deposited into the general fund. And this is directly related to the same type of issue regarding the sweep and how much the general fund owes the CBR and how much the general fund repays the CBR. So we already have concerns with interpretations by the administration on how they're preparing their financial statements in regards to the CBR. So, you know, depending on how this goes, we'll be taking a look at it. It's whether or not it's quantitatively material, we believe that the CBR is qualitatively material to the public, to the residents of Alaska, and we spend a lot of time making sure that the financial statements are accurate in regards to that subfund. So we'll take a look at that, and the timing will be, you know, the late fall, early winter, as far as what we come out. There, another concern I have with what I heard today was, I don't know if I'm understanding it right, But there may be some looking back into the amounts available as of the end of FY21, decided maybe later on in the spring as they're balancing the monies that they get in during the fiscal year. Well, that logistically cannot happen. The financial statements are prepared, balances are decided as of June 30th. So that's determined in the September. We audit it, we produce a financial the opinion on the financial statement. So I don't understand logistically how the administration plans to change the balances during the year.
Okay, well, we'll work on that issue. So what you're, if I'm hearing you correctly, there may be some concern or significant concerns of appropriations being released that should not be released under this scenario.
Through the chair or the chair Stedman, you know, we don't focus on necessarily the budgetary as far as releasing appropriations and whatnot. What we're mainly concerned is the amounts in footnote 2 that talk about how much has been taken out or how much exists or the balance of the CBR fund. That's the particular area of the financial statements which we have to determine is correct. The Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund is a part of the general fund for financial statement purposes. So these discussions don't impact the accounting of and the financial statements of the state. Mainly it has to do with the state compliance, whether the state's following the law, and footnote 2, which provides those balances as part of the footnotes to the financial statements.
Okay. So the SBR, the appropriation potentially out of the SBR, if it was swept and classified historically, or we operated under the historical precedents, it would be swept on June 30th. So if there's appropriations out of it, that should have been swept because of the new interpretation, is that going to run us afoul in the audit?
That's something we'd have to look at the court case and what direction that gives us as far as who's right or wrong on that issue. I would take guidance from Megan Wallace and the Legislative Legal Services on their interpretation and look at the support that she provides in interpreting that. That I consider a separate issue than the taking the subfunds and classifying those subfunds as validly committed as of June 30th. That's one of the biggest concerns I've heard today. I'm not as concerned with the SBR because I'm hearing that there's some type of court case that's going to justify that position.
Okay. We have questions for Ms. Curtis.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Wilson.
Senator Wilson, you have a question?
Yes. Ms. Curtis, how long have these misstatements been going on? Has it just been this year of this, or has it been going on since the prior administration? And is there an easy way to get an answer, definitive answer, to how these statements should be made?
Senator Wilson, through the chair, if you're asking about for how long has the financial statements opinions been qualified, that began in FY18. It did originate under the prior administration's decision right at the end of the prior administration, and then the new administration came on, and those questions, concerns were brought up with this new administration to ensure that they were agreeing with the prior administration's position. So they originated, however, under the prior administration.
Okay. Other questions?
Thank you.
Oh, and just as a side note, we're hoping that we'll get some of this stuff cleared up as we go forward. Any other questions? I'd like to go ahead and thank Ms. Curtis for coming forward today. And Mr. Painter, Mr. Steininger, Ms. Mills, Ms. Wallace, Ms. Curtis, coming in on August afternoon. That'll conclude the meeting today. Thank everybody for coming and listening. We have a brief comment from the co-chair before I adjourn.
Brief. One thing I heard today, and I'm glad the staff's behind us to hear what was said, but I thought I heard we might have to, until this is cleared up, we might have to double the appropriations in the budget for some of these accounts.
Okay. Well, we'll work on how we go forward so we make less of a mess than more of a mess. We'll go ahead and announce upcoming meetings on basis. We will be having some meetings. I'll be gone tomorrow. We're planning meetings on Wednesday, and we have a couple other presentations in the can. So we'll just see how things go and unroll in the building. But just for those members listening, we'll definitely be having meeting Wednesdays, and I'll speak with the co-chair. He might have something tomorrow. I'm not sure yet. So that we are adjourned.